Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Almost four decades ago, the big book, The Joy of Sex, was a publishing and cultural phenom, a how-to book for couples and more out of the heart of the then-young sexual revolution. It was a kind of cheeky sexual cookbook with sections titled Starters, Main Courses, Sauces and Pickles. It was illustrated with a shaggy 60s look. It was touchingly earnest, and it sold millions of copies. Now a brand new version is out in an all-new era. This hour, On Point, The Joy of Sex in 2009. You can join the conversation. Do you remember the first edition and what it stood for, celebrated? How do you see our relationship with sex having changed since 1972? Before we get started, a gentle warning to listeners around the country. We're talking about mature subject matter today. Be forewarned. Joining me now from New York is Susan Quilliam, relationship psychologist, sexologist, and agony aunt. That's British for advice columnist. She's the first woman to revise Alex Comfort's 1972 original work, The Joy of Sex. Her new version, edition, out this month is The Joy of Sex, The Timeless Guide to Lovemaking. Susan, it's great to have you with us.
Hello, Tom. It's great to be with you.
And with us from Burbank, California, is Pepper Schwartz. She's a professor of sociology at the University of Washington and a sexologist who's written advice columns for Glamour magazine and PerfectMatch.com. Her most recent book is Prime, Adventures and Vice, and Advice on Sex, Love, and the Sensual Years. Pepper Schwartz, welcome back. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Susan, first to you. There have been updates over the years, and now you've got a big new edition with you, female at the helm, editing this thing. Why did we need, did you need, did the, I guess we can imagine why the publisher needed, but why a new edition of The Joy of Sex?
A new edition because, as you've just said, in 40 years a lot has changed. The science has changed. The cultural context has changed. Sex itself hasn't changed, but some things like internet sex, sex shows, sex stores, sex toys, those have changed. And, as you've also just said, the publisher decided that, sadly, Alex Comfort having died in 2000, they needed a woman's viewpoint. And so I have added that woman's viewpoint to the book.
Alex Comfort, the original author, who was he and how did he come up with The Joy of Sex in the first place?
Well, originally he was an English general practitioner who, in the wake of the sexual revolution that accompanied the pill, realised that a lot of his patients were coming to him and they didn't know what to do. They didn't know where to find things and what to do with them when they got them. And so he put together some leaflets, along with his partner at the time, put together some leaflets and then developed that into some presentations. And then shortly before he moved to America to work in America, he teamed up with the publisher Mitchell Beasley, who had just released a book called Joy of Cooking, which had done very well. They thought, what a good idea,
right.
Joy of Sex. And hence the book was born.
Pepper Schwartz, you've been in this field for a long time. How do you remember that time, 1972, when the first Joy of Sex came out, and what it represented then, Pepper?
Well, in 1972, I had just gotten my PhD from Yale, and I was starting at the University of Washington. And I was part of a group of feminists, I think, who had gotten into sex research to amend the absence of attention to and perspective of women. So I was very keen on whatever was coming out and was trying to be part of the group that added research as opposed to just opinion or values to the information that was being shared. There was a big vacuum. That's what happened. Mm. That's why I got into research about sexuality. And, of course, it was also a time of personal liberties being taken by women who had been judged by their sexuality and in many ways oppressed and certainly kept ignorant. So any addition was great. Nonetheless, The Joy of Sex, I thought at the time, main contribution, and it's still a wonderful contribution, were these gorgeous pictures. In this case, they were drawn. Now they've got some photos in there, mm-hmm. too, showing you exactly what it looked like to do this position or that position. There was information which wasn't widely shared yet. So we were greedy little consumers of tell me more and then let's test it.
Susan Quilliam, were people really that much in the dark about sex and sex lives? Did they really need a cookbook to do it? I mean, the basic equipment's been around a long time.
Well, not only were they in need, as Pepper said, but in fact, as an advice columnist, I get hundreds of thousands of letters a year from people who are still in need. You know, even in our sexualized society, we are getting inaccurate messages, and we are getting messages that don't empower us and don't make us confident. So, yes, they did need a book in 1972. I would argue they still need accurate and supportive information even now.
And what about the perspective you brought to it as a female editor? I think I've heard you say that the original edition was written by a man for men, but it wasn't presented that way, certainly. It was presented as for everybody, male and female, yet it's been called this sort of super phallocentric book, edition one of The Joy of Sex. What was missing? What have you brought, Susan?
I would agree that it was phallocentric. I mean, I wouldn't criticise it. I think for its time, and considering the author and the market at the time, Alex Comfort made a very good stab at writing a book for everybody. But working on the book, I mean, even just on the level of language, I had to go through and mark every time he said you, meaning the reader, that you was male. So I had to change every single element where he used you and rewrite it so that it was relevant to both male and female. So what I hope I've brought is a 2009 female view, a balanced view. I mean, my brief was to write the book that Alex Comfort would have written were he alive today. I think I've done more than that. I've written the book that Alex Comfort and I would have written as a man and a woman together. So I hope I've redressed the admitted phallocentricism of the original book.
Pepper, how about it? Do you see that evolution? Do you see it in the new edition? And does it fundamentally change the way we look at, talk about, right sex? We've had the women's movement really blossom in the decades since edition one.
Oh, yes. I think this is an area now that's flooded with a lot of information that unfortunately doesn't get to some people. I teach a very large class at the University of Washington on the sociology of sexuality, about 750 students. And the very last day, I give them the ability to ask any question they want, which is anonymously written on pieces of paper. And I notice that some of them are all very basic still, even though the information's out there. Probably the most common one I still get from women, and this is women in their 20s now, is how do I have an orgasm?
Yes.
Well,
yes.
You know, that's important, and I try and tell them about it. But it's not that the information isn't out there, but somehow a lot of people still feel inhibited about going about finding out what they need. And so, you know, everything's a contribution, but the Internet, for example, has been huge in giving new information to people very quickly. And, of course, they're having their own experience now way younger. So it's not like they're not out there having sex, but they're still information deprived, if you can see the paradox in that.
We're going to get into what's known and what's not known, what people are still looking for, even in the Internet age, perhaps, between the covers of a book. Susan Quilliam, I can't get past the title, The Joy of Sex. Of course, it was taking off of The Joy of Cooking, but nevertheless, it was the kind of spirit of that time. A lot of water over the dam since then in terms of AIDS and changing relationships and maybe not quite such a dewy-eyed, innocent view of sex. Is The Joy of Sex still out there? Is it still a title that resonates with the reality of your potential readership?
I think it's a title that resonates because we don't have as much of it as we did.
As much sex or as much joy?
as much joy. I mean, in fact, it's arguable some statistics show that we're not having as much sex because we don't have as much time. But certainly I feel there is less joy. And I've, in Great Britain, where the book was launched a few months ago, I've been asked to do a number of presentations about reclaiming the joy of sex. And I think that we can argue that nowadays we have more hedonism. You know, we are allowed to make love with more people. As Pepper said, we do it earlier. We do it, you know, in more positions. We are a much more sexualized society. But we have lost the innocence. We've lost the naivety. And we now know the dangers of sex, not only sexual infections, but the dangers of abuse, the emotional dangers of sleeping with somebody and then they walk away the next morning, or sleeping with somebody for 25 years and then they, you know, suddenly announce that they're sleeping with somebody else. So I think that we are much more wary of sex than we were. And there is an argument that we need to reclaim the joy of sex, even though sex is all around us.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about an all-new edition of The Joy of Sex. Almost four decades after the original blockbuster edition dared to show and tell all. Susan Quilliam, editor of the new edition, first female editor of The Joy of Sex, is with us from New York, and Pepper Schwartz is here from Burbank, California. She's at the University of Washington in Seattle, author of Prime, Adventures and Advice on Sex, Love, and the Sensual Years. It's more mature subject matter than we've usually got here, so be forewarned on that front. Let's take a call from Siobhan in Plimpton, Massachusetts. Hi, Siobhan, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. Just a quick kudos to the artist who actually did all the drawings in that book. His name was Clem Nicarelli. He passed away in 2008. He was a brilliant artist and a fantastic friend to all of us.
Is this the artist of the first, the original edition, Siobhan? Or the?
Yes, it is.
Wow.
The original edition, sir.
And did you know him?
Yes, I did. He was I was a model for him for about 13 years. And he's a great, he was a fantastic artist, a brilliant man. And he had funny, funny stories about doing the drawings, because people actually have to pose for those positions while doing the drawings.
Now, these are the line drawings in the original 1972 work. Can you tell us his stories? Are they arable?
Yeah, actually, just a simple little quirky. He was an old Italian man, brilliant, funny, funny. And he'd say, you know, you'd be doing the drawings, and they'd work for maybe an hour, 2 hours at a time, and then they'd have to take a break. Because you can only pose in a position for so long without muscle tension and pain.
No doubt.
And there were times during the day where they'd, you know, work, break, and then he would be asked nicely if he could step out of the room for, say, an hour or so. And then he'd come in, and they'd be refreshed, and they would continue with their drawing.
Siobhan, stick with us for a second here, because I love your stories. Ariel Levy had a wonderful story in The New Yorker about this, remarking, as many have, that the guy in those old drawings was very much in the sort of style of that time, long hair, bearded. She wrote, he looks like a werewolf with a hangover, heavily bearded, hair long, and it always seemed a little greasy. But I thought she said, Susan, that the illustrations in the 1972 edition were from Polaroids that Alex Comfort himself had taken of himself and, I believe, a mistress, a woman he was having an affair with. What's the story?
She did say that indeed, and I've heard a number of stories about this. The only one that I can attest to, because it involved a current friend of mine, or a friend I've known for 20 years, was that the pictures for Foursomes and Moresomes, which illustrates two couples making love together, actually involved my friend, his girlfriend, his girlfriend's daughter, and her boyfriend in a small room above a health food shop in Cambridge, England. And the photographer came in and took half a day's worth of photographs, and the illustrator of the time worked from those. So that's the only one I can attest to. But it's fascinating to hear Siobhan's account of the models. I don't think my friend, his partner, her daughter and her boyfriend took a refreshment break in quite the same way Siobhan is describing.
Hard work, but somebody had to do it.
Somebody had to do it, yes.
Siobhan, thanks for bringing the original artist sort of memories to life for us here today. Thanks very much for calling.
You're very welcome.
Let's go to Dave in Bloomingdale, New York. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I've got a question for Susan that has been kind of on my mind quite a while. The sexual revolution, has it made the media more allowed to be descriptive of sex crimes? My five-year-old daughter hears these things on the radio about oral sex and on the TV, and, you know, she's asking me these questions, and I never thought about it before. So
the permission granted once books like The Joy of Sex were out there and how it's evolved in the media. Susan, what do you see in the UK? And Pepper, I'll come to you on the American front.
Certainly in the UK, and to be honest with you, I think that now we have the internet, we're talking a worldwide phenomenon,
yeah,
is that children are learning earlier and earlier what certain terms are. The problem is, and this is why we need good, solid, accurate material, be that book or web, they don't necessarily learn the values behind them. Certainly in Britain, there's a deal of concern about the fact that adolescent boys, for example, are getting their role models of sexuality from porn movies, which give completely wrong messages. So, yeah, I have a lot of sympathy with Dave's attitude. The only thing I would say is that, obviously, to all listeners, if you can talk with your children about sexuality, the research suggests that the more this is dealt with at home and in school rather than with the peer group, the better the values will be.
Pepper, Susan writes and talks about the sort of innocence that was there in 1972. She says, in a way, though, the generation that plunged into this new field, you know, knocked down a lot of walls, and now things travel sometimes where they shouldn't. Maybe robs us of some of the innocence, maybe robs us of some of the joy. How do you see the way sexuality sits in American culture now, you know, all over the place, as our caller says, in this more sexualized time?
Got a couple hours.
Well, one subject,
you know. I'm not a big fan of innocence, because sometimes it's confused with ignorance, and I think we need to be knowledgeable. And I think it's been well proven that knowledge does not necessarily jade or hurt our sexual expression. It helps us make good decisions. And so I don't mind knowledge. On the other hand, the form it's given is sometimes very confusing to both the reader and doesn't help promote a good discussion. I really think that while a lot of the media has given us this topic, that we really have Bill Clinton to thank for coverage in the dailies. This stuff was never talked about, particularly oral sex, until Bill and Monica became irretrievably present on every type of media every day for an enormous amount of time. And then when it entered the news, when it entered improbable channels of information, parents were suddenly faced with their kids saying, as this man has, what's oral sex? And they were unprepared to have to deal with that coming into their living rooms, you know, in the family hour, etc. So we did destroy certain kind of protective places that now cover things in ways that they didn't before then. I do feel, just as Susan has said, that what parents need to do is prepare themselves for what sex educators call teachable moments. They are the moment of truth that parents dread in many ways. But if they become the channels of information, of imparting their own values, then they don't have to have their kids grow up with the kind of misinformation and fear that many of my generation and certainly previous generations grew up with.
But what about, you say it doesn't have to leave people jaded, but of course you also point out that the information can come in all kinds of ways, some suitable, I guess, and others not. You work with young people in a university setting. Do you see, on the scale of joy to jadedness, if that's the right sort of spectrum, do you see a drift toward jadedness overall, in spite of the fact that you welcome the knowledge?
Well, I'll tell you, I don't think people as fragile as we paint them. One of the things that's changed greatly from the early 70s to today is the popularity and almost general practice of hooking up among young high school students and college students.
And please define that, because you'll have half our listeners who are never quite sure what that means.
Hooking up can mean anything from just meeting at a movie for a movie or having sex in various combinations. It does mean something that wasn't planned. It happens suddenly. It doesn't have great meaning. It doesn't have to be a committed partner in any way. And it really could be. It could be making out, or it could be having intercourse. So it is a confusing term. But let's take it at its most extreme way. That is to say, a lot of these young people have some form of sex fairly early on, mean age about 16, 15 and a half, depending on the group. Mm. And while that's gone up a little, down a little bit over the last 10 years, basically we're talking about high school students, so that by the time they're 19, about 80% have had intercourse. Now, that means that a lot of them have had it under circumstances that, you know, would make their parents blanch and sad. But the fact is that it goes through the 20s, and then by the late 20s, they're done with it. Now, the question is—
Done with what exactly? With the hookup culture, the casual sex culture?
With the hookup culture, with the casual culture. For the most part, you know, they find out that, okay, I know all the mechanics, and this isn't what I want.
Emotionally.
And you say, okay, right, exactly. And so are they damaged at that point? Can they not have an intimate relationship? Is sex no longer special? And my experience with it is that's not true. Now, for some of them, yes, some of them will have accumulated some very unhappy experiences. But, you know, tell me somebody my generation or before that hasn't had unhappy experiences with sex, right?
You're right.
So I think they're better prepared, though, because we do have a dialogue, and they can go on to the next, and I hope, better place for sex and intimacy and trust and all of that kind of commitment.
Susan, did the first edition of The Joy of Sex pave the road from those dewy days to where we are now with the hooking up culture? Do you give it that credit?
Yes, if that's a credit. if it is credit. Yes, in some ways I do. Joy of Sex not only reflected what was happening in society, but it also, to a large extent, created it. There had been sex manuals before, but The Joy of Sex, as Pepper said earlier, had the pictures, and also it had a very permission-giving, very liberated attitude to sex. I think that, as I said before, the internet has played a large part here. But also we have to remember that today, more or less worldwide, our attitude to sex education is very different. There was no sex education, certainly in Britain, in 1972. I was lucky. My parents gave me sex education. But largely, there was very little. And I think that the sort of situation that Pepper is describing, where young people are having sex, they are moving away from casual sex into couple sex. I think The Joy of Sex started that, but it also built values as well as permission.
Tell us some more about what was in there in these pages in 1972 that's out in 2009, if you would, Susan. And what's there now that wasn't there in 79?
Well, 72. Indeed. Mm-hmm. On a light note, we read through Sex on a Motorbike and Sex on Horseback.
Those were in the original. And a moving motorcycle, as I recall.
And a moving motorcycle.
Good
and
heavens.
A moving
Is that horse. Necessary?
But remember, the thing about Joy of Sex, it was aspirational. You read it and thought, I would never do that.
Okay. Did other Superman.
People do that?
Those are
it's
out.
But
they're out because it was ridiculous or...
Because it's dangerous, and okay. Certainly in some countries it's illegal.
Yeah. Right, pull over, Mr. Miss, Madam. Okay, what else?
In terms of what is missed out, there was a lot, not so much in the first version, but in the second version, which was written after the AIDS crisis, there was an awful lot of very negative, very sex-negative material. The original section... which dealt with, quote, problems, and which included things like the menopause and homosexuality defined as a complete problem. Those have been redistributed throughout the book with a much more sex-positive tone. And then I've added sections on new science, hormones, pheromones, our greater understanding of female and male physiology, our greater understanding of sexual problems and solutions to those problems, sections on sex therapy, sections indeed on sex education, but also a whole slew of things around new attitudes and new practices, internet sex, phone sex, and as I mentioned earlier, the greater availability in sex stores.
And if they were promoting almost in 1972 foursomes and moresomes, are you now promoting the couple, the two? Is this part of your emotional, greater awareness of the emotional impact of sex and sexuality?
I think what Alex Comfort said was that the best sex is performed within the couple, but he also, in many, many places in the book, reflected the beliefs of the time, although I have to say I'm not sure they were carried through with most couples, the belief of the time that it was not only permissible, but possible to have sex with a number of people and jealousy not to be a problem. We now know that that simply isn't true. You can hook up, but once you settle into a stable relationship, it can be very damaging, very upsetting to be, you know, having sex elsewhere, for a partner to have sex elsewhere. All I have done in the new book is to reflect that shift of awareness. I haven't been pedantic. I hope I haven't been prissy. I have said that one needs to negotiate one's own fidelities at each stage of life. But I have made it clear that we now know a great deal more than Alex Comfort did about the dangers and, in fact, the power of sex.
And, of course, flipping through, I don't recall seeing drawings here of more than two at a time. Let's go to Elin in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Elin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you know?
I just wanted to share, 11 years ago at our wedding, we got a wonderful gift, a beautiful bottle of olive oil, and a copy of The Joy of Cooking, and a copy of The Joy of Sex, and on the bottle of oil was a note that said, to be used with either book.
Oh,
that's a pretty good sense of humor.
Yeah.
Is the oil gone, Elin?
11 years.
That's wonderful.
That's
great. But half seriously, I mean, did you crack it open? Was it useful to you, or just a good joke to put next to the cookbook on the shelf with the oil?
It was. We laughed a lot. We've had a lot of fun, and I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, and that's great, Elin. Thanks so much, Pepper Schwartz. I mean, do couples dip into books like this today together, or is this for, you know, the Lonely Hearts Club, wondering, wishing? I don't know. Who wants it? Who reads it?
Oh, I think couples, absolutely. I mean, you know, you could tell from the caller. It's fun. It's, you know, mm-hmm. You have to be able to laugh about sex. And you're like, hey, how did they do that position? I don't, you know, what's the geometry of that? And
Right. There's
a giggle, whether or not it's satisfying in any other way. I think actually there's one of the big changes, if I would say, from that early years of sex reveal to the present, is that couples will talk about things more. They do feel the permission has changed over the years. They can talk more. They don't talk enough, but they talk. I think, again, in my parents' generation, you might go a lifetime without a discussion about what you were doing or wanted to do. These kinds of things allow a conversation, encourage them, and I think help intimacy greatly.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about an all-new edition of The Joy of Sex. Almost four decades after the original blockbuster edition dared to show and tell all. Susan Quilliam is with us, relationship psychologist, advice columnist, co-author, and reinventor of The Joy of Sex, the ultimate revised edition, just out. And Pepper Schwartz is here joining us from Burbank, California, from the University of Washington. She's author of Prime, Adventures and Advice on Sex, Love, and the Sensual Years. A gentle warning, it's mature subject matter today. If you're just joining us, Derek is calling us from Brookline, Massachusetts. Derek, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think this is a great show. I wish there were more of them like this discussing this topic. I come to this. I'm a psychiatrist in town. I see couples and individuals. And I've been working in the area of sexuality and sexual therapy for the last 35 years. So there are a number of observations. The discussion has been terrific. First of all, you raised the question, are people in need of this information? And
yeah.
I couldn't stress enough. I think that the level of ignorance and also the kind of sex-negative attitudes in this country are huge. If you think about the sex ed stuff in the schools, the abstinence only isn't even worth commenting about, except that it was really quite dangerous and did not serve our youth well. The sex ed programs in the schools, which are under siege, I think can be summed up as have sex, you'll die, because the focus initially is usually on the AIDS and sexually transmitted disease.
Is that what you mean by sex-negative attitudes then, Derek?
Well, yeah, you know, I think that we think that we're so positive because there's so much in the media, but I don't think that there are any good models, by and large, for us in terms of how do you talk with each other about sexuality. You start off talking about parents talking with their kids about sex. Most parents will avoid that like the plague and will wait until their kids are 13 and 14 and then sit down uncomfortably talking about sex. They've got to have the conversation. And they're uncomfortable, the kids are uncomfortable, and they want to get it over with as soon as possible.
Has that changed?
No, I don't think that's changed at all.
And what about the joy factor, Derek? You've been listening to people for 35 years. The joy of sex is the title. What about the actual joy in day in and day out, week out among the people you talk with?
Tom, I'll tell you. I was thinking about this, listening to everybody. I don't think that there's been a lot of change. I think that, there's been more awareness. I think that, Bill Clinton raised the awareness of oral sex. I think that Lorena Bobbitt actually got penis on the air. Bob Dole brought in ED, erectile difficulties. But by and large, I don't think that that's been something that's changed. At this point, I see huge numbers of couples where the major complaint is we don't have sex, low sexual desire. And the stereotype would be, it's the women who don't have sexual desire, but more and more in my office, it's actually the men.
What do you attribute that to, Derek?
A whole range of things. I think that, first of all, our lifestyles, particularly with dual career families, are just chaotic. Most people say, by 10 or 11 o'clock at night, I just want to get to sleep, maybe watch Jon Stewart, but that's all about I can manage. And then I think that there are issues around intimacy. This is where any kind of sexual therapy has to encompass that, knowing something about whether people want to be intimate. There are issues around depression. We now know much more about hormonal factors in both men and women, low testosterone in both men and women. We know about people who've been sexually abused as kids, around 15% of boys, 25% of women.
But you say get it out there and talk about it, and couples still have trouble doing that after all this time.
Absolutely. Because, you see, Tom, they don't talk about it. One of the things I've realized that I do more than anything else is to provide a place in which people can talk about it.
Derek, let us pick that up, and I thank you very much for your call. Pepper, first to you, what about the skill that couples have today in our sexualized society, as you point out, in actually talking about the details of their own sexual relationship in their most intimate relationships? Let's say in a marriage or long-term relationships, are people able to do it? Do books like this help?
Well, I think younger people are learning some of that language, but not enough because, in fact, as the caller said, and I agree with everything he said, although my one caution would be that he is a therapist, so he sees the people in trouble, not the people who are happy. And so I think it's not quite as disastrous a picture as he's painting, but it's true about the people he sees, for sure. I do see some difference in younger women, for example, feeling more empowered to talk about what they want, when they want it, how they want it, but not nearly so much as they should because, of course, he's right. I mean, most of the sex education they get is negative and protective as opposed to joyful. I would say there are some beacons of light out there that help people. I know the Unitarian Church, for example, has a really great sex ed program in many of their institutions where people talk about values and pleasure and things that would never get in the public system. Nonetheless, people are generally embarrassed And women and men can be in relationships, marriages of many years, and never have said, you know, you're doing that wrong. That's not what really pleases me. And by the 20th year mark, they're afraid to say it because that means the last 19
years
they weren't happy, you know? So communication would be the biggest thing we could add to the joy of sex. Absolutely.
Let's go to Steve in Andover, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Very well.
Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
Quick question. Well, question and a follow-up question, actually. I know the original joy of sex, it was pretty much exclusively for heterosexuals. And
yes.
I didn't know if the new one out addressed anything about homosexuals, if there was a chapter or carve-outs within chapters geared towards homosexuals. Because, I mean, I know there's a lot of misinformation out there regarding heterosexual sex and what you do and don't do. But
we'll address that, Steve. What's your follow-on, if I may?
What's that?
We'll address that. What's your follow-on, if I may ask?
Well, I can't.
You said you had a second question?
Oh, the second question is, if it's not in there,
Was
it considered to be put in there, and why was it not?
Big and good question. Let us pick it up. Susan Quilliam, how about it? Homosexuality and the new edition of The Joy of Sex, where does it stand?
I'm really glad you asked that question, Steve. The original book didn't deal with homosexuality, and in fact, the second and third editions in the wake of the AIDS crisis were sadly very critical. What we decided to do, revising the book, was we are building a series of Joy of Sex books, and one of these is going to be devoted completely to gay sex. So therefore, the book that we're talking about now, the original re-edition, is homosexual positive. I not only devote a couple of sections to sexual preference, but I thread throughout the book references to homosexual positivity. But what I also do is to say that this is, we need, in respect, to devote a whole separate book to this. I didn't want to compromise by trying to bundle everything in. So there will be another book in, I think, about 18 months' time. I hope that answers your question.
So it's on its way, Susan promises. Thanks for your call, Steve. Laurie in Jericho, Vermont, you're on the air.
Well, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting show, but I'd like to make one comment that I feel that the part of the uncomfortableness that people feel is that there's too much emphasis on the actual physical part. I think that a lot of the difficulties people have is because they think that sex is just that physical part, and they don't take into account there is a huge emotional and intimate side to sex, and that I think it's really dangerous for the children in this generation to see it just as this physical thing, and I think we see, especially in the young females, just this dangerous side effect that, they are affected emotionally.
So let's get the whole picture. Lori, let us pick that up, because I think Susan Quilliam has gone at exactly that issue in the new edition. Susan, what about the evolution between 1972 and your edition in terms of addressing the emotional weight and side of sexuality?
I mean, I was around in 1972, and I remember that the attitude in many quarters was that sex was something you could have without engaging your emotions. And Alex Comfort goes a long way down that road, although to do him justice, he makes a call for emotion more than many people were doing at the time. We now know, exactly as Laurie has said, that in many, many cases, particularly for women, there is an emotional link. And I was looking even just a couple of weeks ago about a very interesting survey with 2,000 young people where they were calling for much more emphasis to be placed on the emotional side of sexuality, not just the biological, not just the car mechanics of sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
I completely agree, and I really hope I've addressed it. That was certainly my aim.
Much more here than in 1972. Let's go to Nicholas in Arlington, Massachusetts. Nicholas, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. This is just such a wonderful topic, and I have so many things to say about this, but I'm going to limit myself to just throwing out a couple of names, because I think that Comfort's book preceded or may have been contemporaneous with some of the most important books, I think, culturally and maybe economically of our time, and it has to do with sexuality, and that's, for example, Our Bodies Ourselves by the Boston Women's Health Book Collective.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm thinking of Woody Allen in one of his in Sleeper, I think, where he sort of makes somebody talks about having the wrong kind of orgasm, and he just slips in there and says, "I've never had the wrong kind of orgasm."
But our bodies ourselves came out as a sort of women's version is the wrong word, but a women's approach to sexuality and everything women would need to know.
And what happened? What I think happened after the Boston Women's Health Book Collective books sort of came out is internationally they were translated immediately and booklegged around the world, and I think recent research has shown that you know the better you educate women about everything, about their bodies, about everything, that it makes a huge economic and cultural shift in that community for the better. And so, I mean, I have to say, you know, I grew up sexually in the 70s, and I had Comfort's book, as one of your guests said, you know, is sort of more aspirational than...
Never quite achieved some of those positions, perhaps. And now Our Bodies Ourselves out at almost the same time. Pepper Schwartz, again, in Ariel Levy's article, she describes... She says, if the joy of sex is like the joy of cooking, Our Bodies Ourselves was like the Moosewood Cookbook. I thought it was very cute.
It's true.
But that was a sort of more organic Birkenstock. And for women, have we come to the point where these two can merge, or do we still have sort of separate, you know, texts for genders?
No. And in fact, a lot of the textbooks for psychology and sociology, sexuality courses in universities across the country and world have a great deal of both female and male-oriented information in them, both educating people about their psychological reactions as well as their physiological ones. And fortunately, a lot of research is going on now that was sad origins. I mean, the HIV crisis mm-hmm. finally funneled some money into sex research, and then it's gone quiescent again. But nonetheless... In that new need to know more about how people actually act in, take risks, why they have sex, when they have sex, we found a lot more information. We found a lot of physiological information that Our Bodies Ourselves started. They said, hey, women, there's nothing about your body and how it works and the relationship to your psyche and your body. Well, now we know a lot more about women's bodies. There's new information, slightly touched on in this book, but greatly elaborated now in the textbooks. And so there's much better information to women, much more. There's a whole society now based on female sexuality, multidisciplinary one. It's a better world for people to be able to understand themselves in. Of course, getting that information out of the researcher's hands, out of the educator's hands, into everybody's home is the big challenge.
Ariel Levy talking about the first edition as having the feel of a penis propaganda pamphlet. Great for Greg in Portsmouth, Rhode Island. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Pleasure to be on here with you. Calling because I represent part of the paradigm shift of sexuality that seems to be going on these days. I run a small maker of pleasure instruments, or sex toys, and
okay.
I'm curious to ask whether the new edition of The Joy of Sex addresses products.
Who buys them, men or women, Greg?
Both. Anybody. Really, anybody that has curiosity to explore their bodies, bringing products into play.
Our time is short, but let's go to it. Susan Quilliam, there one word I had never heard before ran across in your new edition, teledildonics. Good heavens, is Greg on the wave of the future?
Yes, I think he is. All the sex toys in the world took up 2 pages for Alex Comfort. I have 10 sections, including teledildonics, which, for the benefit of readers, of listeners, is where you're at one computer, your beloved is at another computer, they have the vibrator, your computer controls it. You can be separated by 3,000 miles. What a thought.
Is that the future, Susan? Is that really the future?
It exists now. It exists now.
I'm reading here.
Tom, I should...
Yes, Pepper.
I just want to add one thing, that one huge change is these places are no longer just on the internet or in sex shops. They're actually at Walmart. You Can't Trojan Now, mainline manufacturer, has a vibrating ring. There's other things that they and other companies manufacture you can get in regular stores. That is a change of just a couple years, and that means a big change in what business and the public is willing to accept.
Sounds like the Jetsons of the future, but maybe it's, I'm reading in the Cincinnati Inquirer just this week about sexting. That is telephone texting, but sexual images being passed around by teenagers. Pepper, is the future really going to be remote and mechanical? Can't we keep the old human, you know, physicality right in there?
Not to worry, Tom. I think flesh on flesh has a future.
Susan Quilliam, it sounds like it does indeed. What's the reception so far for the latest edition? Is there still a market with the internet buzzing away out there, as it were?
There is absolutely a market, I'm delighted to say, and it sounds like everybody who's been listening and everybody who's talking is committed to putting the joy back into sex.
Well, let's vote for that. Susan Quilliam, editor of the new The Joy of Sex, the Ultimate Revised Edition, joining us today from New York. Thank you very much for being with us, Susan.
Thank you.
And Pepper Schwartz, it's always great to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Pepper Schwartz's new book is Prime, Adventures and Advice on Sex, Love, and the Sensual Years. You can continue the conversation at onpointradio.org. We'll go out with Ethel Waters, 1929, Do I Know What I'm Doing? This is On Point.
I think I never knew what delight meant, and I'm so full of excitement. I think I'm losing my right mentality, honestly. Do I know what I'm doing? Am I in a rut, or am I just a nut? Do you think I am? Do I give a damn while I'm in love?